Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of House S to order. It's about 3:30 on Tuesday, March 1st, and President and Representative Vasquez, Representative Tallarico, Representative Wohl, myself, Chair Seaton, Representative Stutz will be joining us in a few minutes. And at this time, I'll remind everybody about their cell phones and addressing questions through the chair. And today we will hold our first hearing and public testimony on House Bill 344, which is Drug Prescription Database. Again, this was the committee's look at opioid addiction problems and trying to get a handle around that. House Bill 344 deals or looks to strengthen the requirements for the prescription drug database. It is not directly involved in revenue, but it does relate to the health care and the potential to reduce abuse and save lives, and a similar component has been added to the Senate Medicaid reform bill, and so we are looking at in that respect with our Medicaid reform bill, which is House Bill 227. So we're bringing up 344 today in order to consider adding it to House Bill 227. And this we'll first introduce the bill, and then we'll hear from the Controlled Substance Advisory Committee, whose white paper on prescription drug monitoring program is in all members' pamphlets or packets. And following that testimony, we'll take public testimony on 344. And we will also, just announcing that we haven't yet closed public testimony on 227, so if time remains at the end, we may go back to that to see if there's any additional testimony. I want to recognize that Representative Tarr has joined us. And with that, can I ask my First Alaskans fellow, Susie Edmondson, and Danica Hansen, our staff aide, to come forward and introduce the bill to us and go through a sectional. Welcome. Would you identify yourself for the record and go ahead with the presentation of the bill?
For the record, my name is Susie Edwardson, and I'll be presenting on HB 344. HB 344 is to strengthen the existing prescription drug database into a tool that will be easier, that will better assist providers with knowing and understanding the status of their patients' prescriptions. It does this by requiring near-time entry of this information into a database to make sure that information is up-to-date as possible, and to prevent excessive prescription within a short time frame. This also allows pharmacists or practitioners to delegate access and submittal authority to an authorized employer agent, and this will remove some of the administrative burden from the practitioner in charge. This also requires that all practitioners who interact with controlled substance shall register with the database. This allows them to truly evaluate their patient's information. The bill is requiring that dispensers check the database prior to dispensing, and by creating an automatic alert system within the database, which will push unsolicited reports to prescribers and pharmacists if the patient dosage or number of prescriptions reach a level of concern.
And let me interrupt, and we've been joined by Representative Stutz.
HB 344 also allows database access to the Medicaid pharmacist and the Medical Drug Utilization Review Committee, to allow them to review prescription drug utilization rates under the program, and the state and the state medical examiner for purposes of investigating a cause of death. De-identified data will be supplied to the Department of Health to allow them to monitor overall health trends in the state. Okay, so the next part will be what our current prescription drug database is not as strong as it could be. Data is only required to be submitted once, or be submitted on a monthly basis, which can leave large gaps in the information that would allow one patient to fill multiple prescriptions without anyone knowing. Some pharmacists send in information more frequently than this, but the database as a whole is only updated monthly. While all pharmacies are required to submit prescription information, registration with the database is not mandatory. Today, approximately 40% of dispensers and only 13.5% of prescribers are registered. The remaining 86.5% of prescribers have no way of knowing if their patient is receiving prescriptions from another prescriber or what dosage. The Board of Pharmacy is in charge of the database. They currently send out unsolicited reports which can alert unsuspecting providers to concerning behavior, but they do not expressly have that authority. HB 344 will give them that authority. If it is the will of the committee, Tanika will go through this sectional of the bill.
Okay, thank you. And does everybody recall our discussions around the problems with the database and why the bills come forward? Okay, so let's go through the sectional then.
All right. So for the record, my name is Tanika Hansen, staff to Representative Paul Seaton. And section one of the bill, this deals with the submittal of information to the database. And so it will allow pharmacists or providers to delegate the submittal of that information to an authorized employee or agent. And then it also requires those pharmacists to submit to the database in near real time in a procedure that's established by the Board of Pharmacy. It's legal's opinion that since this section, statute 17.30.200B, deals with submittal, and the next section, which is subsection D, deals with access, we need to allow delegation authority specifically in both those sections. So section 2 is the section that deals with access to the database, and that it currently requires that this information be confidential and then outlines who's permitted to access it. Under this bill, we are adding access to a delegated authorized agent or employee of the pharmacist or practitioner. It also grants access to the lead Medicaid pharmacist, the Medicaid Utilization Review Committee, for the purpose of reviewing Medicaid utilization, drug utilization. And it's also granted to the state medical examiner for investigation and to employees of public health, but only in de-identified batches. Section 3, which is page 4, line 5, amends statute to state that the failure of a pharmacist or a provider to register or submit information to the database is grounds for the board to take disciplinary action. This section currently states that failure to submit information would be grounds for disciplinary action, but the bill is adding the requirement that they also register with the database. Section 4, which is page 4, line 11, deletes the language stating that dispensers or practitioners are not obligated to check the database prior to dispensing. And this is to conform with a requirement in Section 5. So Section 5, page 4, would require that a dispenser or their delegated employee or agent shall check the database for patient prescription records prior to dispensing and shall also submit the prescription information to the database in near real time to when the prescription is dispensed. And then it also directs the Board of Pharmacy to develop the procedure and time frame for practitioners to register with the database. Section 6 adds four new subsections. Subsection O is an exemption for practitioners or pharmacists who cannot update the database in near real time due to technological barriers, so it would allow them to apply in writing for an exemption to that near real time requirement. Subsection P would create an automatic electronic alert system when someone has prescriptions inconsistent with general standards. As Susie mentioned, the Board of Pharmacy does send out these alerts right now, but they don't have express authority. And their current threshold for sending out an alert like that would be for someone who had obtained controlled substances from five or more prescribers and or from five or more pharmacies within a three-month time period. And subsection Q requires all healthcare providers who prescribe, dispense, or administer a controlled substance to register with the prescription drug database. And then subsection R directs the Board of Pharmacy to notify all the necessary medical boards when one of their practitioners registers with the database. And registering with the database is the way that a practitioner would access it for patient information. Somebody who's not registered may submit a request to a Board of Pharmacy, to the Board of Pharmacy, but that, you know, requires them to send in a request to prove that they have a patient relationship with the patient, and then get the information back from the board. So it would be much more, much slower than just registering. And Section 7 allows the Board of Pharmacy to adopt all the necessary regulations in order to implement the act. Section 8, which is page 6, directs the Board of Pharmacy to provide all the necessary information and training to the relevant boards, which would be the State Medical Board, the Board of Nursing, the Board of Dental Examiners, and the Board of Examiners in Optometry, to assist their licensees in registering and in complying with the requirements of the Act. It also delays that mandatory registration for 180 days after the effective date of this bill. As Susie noted, 86% of prescribers and 60% of dispensers are not currently registered, so we created a delayed effective date to give them time to get the information out and to get registered. Section 9, page 6, is the authority. It states that the board's authority to draft regulations takes effect on July 1st of 2016. And then Section 10 states that the changes created by the bill will take effect in January 1st of 2017.
Well, thank you. Are there questions? Seeing none, there were some changes or some proposed changes.
So we don't have any draft amendments, but we've had some conversations since bringing the bill up about some possible concerns. And one is the delegation of authority. It's really important for relieving the burden from, you know, an ER doctor or the pharmacist in charge who has a lot of time or a lot of demands on their time to be able to delegate authority. But if you delegate to an employee who isn't licensed or registered in some way with the state, then there's not a very good tool, enforcement tool for them if they improperly use the information. So some suggestions we've gotten and we would be considering an amendment to would be to add language that states that the delegation of authority could only be to a licensed or registered employee. So that would still cover certified nurses' assistants, dental hygienists, kind of a wide range of providers, but only providers who have some connection with the state medical boards that could then enforce actions on them. And then there's been conversation about the near real-time requirement and whether or not that will be really costly. And I think you have some letters on your desk which comment on that issue. We know currently that the database can be updated weekly for not much additional cost. And we're looking into whether it could be updated on a daily basis and what the cost for that would be. But we chose the term near real time because it gave a little bit more flexibility than real time, but implied a certain urgency. But that's definitely important that we get that time frame to be as timely as possible, but also practical for the providers.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is the right time for questions.
Yes.
Okay. What you were saying earlier about the people entering the data have to be a licensed person of the with a state license. I don't know what the exact language was. So if you're working at a pharmacy and you're not a pharmacist, let's say at Fred Meyer's Pharmacy, what other people besides pharmacists are licensed? Are pharmacy techs licensed? Is everyone working behind the counter have some sort of license?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, I will partially answer that and then ask that the I know that there are some people from the Board of Pharmacy who may be able to better answer that, but it would be more than just the lead pharmacist. I believe that pharmacist techs are also registered at least with the state, and so most, I think, people in the offices would be registered or licensed with the state, just like, you know, the secretary that hasn't necessarily gone through a background check and isn't registered with any board wouldn't be able to enter information. But it would definitely allow for delegation. You wouldn't, right now the bill the law requires that the lead pharmacist in charge of the pharmacy enter the information, and they have a lot of demands on their time, so we would like to spread that out more.
Follow up, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I could see how the lead pharmacist might want not to that be the only person that could do that job. Is the requirement that they have a license so that if there was punitive action, they could revoke a license? Or, I mean, I'm just using, for example, let's say someone works in the DMV and they have access to records, and at the same, if they mishandled them or entered them wrong or intentionally misentered them, that would have large ramifications, same as this one. But I don't believe they're licensed, but they could still be punished in some way. I mean, is the reason for licensure so that you can reprimand more effectively?
Representative Wohl, through the chair, yes. There's a part of the bill that states that failure to submit information or failure to register can lead to disciplinary action for the board, and that's very much what we would have in mind for the employees who are submitting the information. It creates a very direct line for disciplinary action because it can go through their board, who can sanction them.
Okay, thank you.
It's not only the dispensers, it's the providers that are delegating the checking to someone who is licensed in their office. So, what we're approaching this whole thing about is that we've got way too many prescriptions for way too many pills, and we're getting addictions, and whether it's, I think you were talking earlier that there were more deaths from the prescription, overuse of prescription, than there was from the heroin, even though people might switch to heroin because it's cheaper or more available. But that's the only way we've been able to figure out how to get a handle on that is to make prescribers check and find out if the person they're prescribing to has had more than recommended filling the prescriptions in the last time. So that's the intent of this, both from the dispenser and the prescriber. And I know there's some prescribers that really don't want to go through the bother, but it's a huge problem in the state. And so we have to have some solution that we're looking at, I think. And that's why that's the genesis of the bill that the whole committee talked about. But I just want to make sure that everybody was realizing that this is changing from just the dispenser having to put in, but it's also the prescribers are going to have to. No, we don't have that in the.
It's only the pharmacists through the chair seat, and it's only the pharmacists that are required to submit information. And we received some testimony that if you're having prescriptions put in, but then the prescriptions aren't filled, then there are no pills out there to be concerned for, and then it might actually have might muddy the waters of the information, because you'll see a high prescription amount for a patient who isn't acting on those prescriptions. So currently, it's just the prescribers that are required to submit information.
The dispensers?
Oh, sorry, yes, dispensers. Thank you. And then the red, the currently in the in this version of the bill, we are requiring all practitioners to register with the database. We had considered putting forward the idea of requiring the providers to check before they prescribed, and we chose initially to go with mandatory registration to get people connected with the database as a first step. But in our office's review of the Senate component in 74, in SB 74, they are requiring prescribers to check the database before prescribing. And so it's definitely that, as the chair indicated, that is the crux of the conversation. And so looking at this bill and looking at other versions, what would be the best option to, the most enforceable option to have prescribers check the database.
And yeah, been looking at too many versions of the issue here. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just two comments. I think, you know, can't overstate the need for this given our current circumstance, and just was, you know, just a couple of years ago we thought it might go away at all together, so we've had this temporary fix, so it's very appropriate. We need a long-term solution. 2 points for me that I just want to understand where we're at right now. It says in the fiscal note, you know, if the fiscal note were not adopted, then the idea would be going back to the fees to the pharmacists. And if I recall, that became sort of problematic in the earlier discussions about this in terms of fairness, because they felt like other healthcare providers needed the information. And so if we get to that point, did we come up with a more holistic sort of solution to accomplish that? And then second thing is, you know, right now we still, because it was the short-term fix, bumped it over to being housed in DCCED. But previously it had been in Department of Health and Social Services, I believe, because I think that was through a federal grant, and it and then that grant went away, and then that's why we had this sort of where do we put it thing. And I guess I just want to make sure, you know, we want to use this as a tool to improve health outcomes. Right now, I don't see any sort of coordination with the Department of Health and Social Services in this. How could we, you know, do we think that they will just communicate with each other? That's a non-issue that could possibly be true. Or how can we ensure that, you know, as we look at services like substance abuse treatment, right, that we don't sort of have siloed approaches here. So we've got a lot of great information over here, but these people don't have it, you know, to make sure that we're understanding our impacts.
Sure. Representative Tarr, through the chair. So our office has looked at that, has discussed that issue of spreading the fees over other boards. We haven't had a chance yet to request that amendment or get that run past the department. But our hope, obviously, is that the federal grant will come through. But if not, we are very interested in language that would spread the cost out over all of the boards of people who are registering and not just the Board of Pharmacy. Okay. And to your second point, I believe it has, I'm not sure, but I think it has been with the Board of Pharmacy the whole time. I can have Commerce follow up on that. The grant is, they currently have a federal grant, which is where our funding is, which came through the Department of Health and Social Services, but it's still under the Board of Pharmacy because they have the investigative authority and the, you know, license authority over the dispensers who are putting information in. And to your question about coordinating on health care and coordinating with the Department of Health, that is a major goal of Section 6, which allows access to the Medicaid pharmacist, the Medicaid Drug Utilization Review Committee, the state medical examiner, and then de-identified information to the Department of Public Health. They have not had that access so far, and I think that they have expressed interest in it, and it's also, those are suggestions that came out of the Controlled Substance Advisory Group. And so by giving the department that access, we can do we can have a better idea of prescription utilization in the Medicaid program, and then a better idea of public health trends.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
I need to find that Department of Public Health. That's the piece I'm not seeing here, but perhaps I can find that later. And I guess, you know, because DCCED, then Division of Occupational Licensing, is underneath that, and then the respective boards, I want to make sure we don't only sort of view it from that lens, but the important health implications. And so I apologize if I missed the part where the Department of Public Health part, and so that's very helpful. Thank you.
Sure.
And if you maybe afterwards can point out that if sure. I don't find it.
It's at the top of page four.
Mm-hmm. Four.
Okay. And Dr. Butler is here, and the Department of Commerce they're here as well. So.
Right, and we'll get to Dr. Butler. Will be the first testifier, but let's go ahead and get through the bill a little bit, make sure we don't have any further questions on it. And did you have a comparison between the two bills that we can go through? I think that's...
Yeah. So just briefly, I would go through a comparison of House Bill 344 and Senate Bill 74. There may be language or things that we'd like to copy from that bill. So Senate Bill 74 currently doesn't allow the delegation of submittal of information, as we do in Section 1 of this bill. It does allow the delegation of access that we have in Section 2 of this bill. House Bill 344 requires submittal of prescription information at near real time. Senate Bill 74 requires weekly submittal, which is more timely than the current monthly submittal, but you know, perhaps not as timely as near real time, although we haven't defined near real time yet. House Bill 344 only requires dispensers to check the database before dispensing, but it requires all healthcare practitioners who deal with controlled substances to register. Senate Bill 74, or the CS for Senate Bill 74, requires everyone to register, and it also requires providers to check before dispensing, prescribing, or administering a drug. I think there may be some changes coming to this section because we've heard in that committee and may hear in this committee concerns making sure that requirement to check before administering doesn't get in the way of emergency care or trauma care. House Bill 344 provides an exemption for pharmacists that can't update the database in near real time due to technological barriers, someone who is remote and doesn't have good broadband or something like that. Senate Bill 74 doesn't have this exemption. It's possible that because they are requiring weekly and not real time, that exemption would not be necessary. We haven't talked to enough providers yet to determine that. And House Bill 344 requires registration with the database, but gives 180 days from the effective date for this to occur to allow additional time to register. So my reading of that would be 180 days after January 1st of 2017. Senate Bill 74 doesn't have this delay in the registration requirement, but the section on the prescription drug database as a whole takes place or goes into effect in January of 2017. So there's a 6 months window for registering, a little bit more than 6 months, but there's not as long of a window as we provide in this bill.
Good, okay, that's just the differences, so we can kind of keep those in mind and see kind of where we want to go with the bill. Are there any other questions for the staff? Seeing none, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just trying to understand the sequence of events. So if an individual goes into a pharmacy to fill a prescription for an opioid or substance that falls under this bill, they would the dispenser, the pharmacist, would first check this person in the database to see if there was any conform with register. Anyhow, to see if they've there's some sort of threshold where they've mm-hmm. gotten too many prescriptions or something, and that's to be determined, and some sort of alarm or something will go off. And if not, they get dispensed, and then either within 24 hours or so, they enter that most recent prescription data. So they get checked before they get the prescription, and then, assuming all is good, they enter the data within 24 hours or a reasonable amount of time. So if someone goes in, they look this person up, there's some sort of threshold or some sort of alarm goes off at that point. This bill doesn't say exactly what happens at that point, correct?
Representative Wohl through the chair, correct, yeah.
And the push notification?
Yes, subsection, I believe it's subsection P, yes, creates an automatic electronic alert system. But that would still require that the dispenser check the database in order to get that alert. But if currently the Board of Pharmacy has that threshold set as prescriptions from five providers and five pharmacies in 3 months as being a level of concern.
And the Board of Pharmacy is here, so we can ask them whether that seems to be the right threshold. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just noticing some of the, you know, we're using the language pharmacist and practitioner. I think pharmacist is probably more clear, but I notice practitioner doesn't have a definition in the bill. So is that something that's defined elsewhere in statute, or do you think that's something we need to be more clear about who the practitioners are?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I'm not positive that it has been defined in statute in this section. I'd have to check on that, but I believe that the bill itself is fairly clear because it says that practitioners that have the ability to dispense, administer, or prescribe, and then it lists the schedules of drugs. So I will check on the definition, but the sections of the bill do, you know, point to healthcare providers who have interactions with these controlled substances. So it's kind of defined right there.
And Mr.
Chair,
thank you. I think probably when we have Dr. Butler up, there's this, we can probably answer this question. But I guess if there's anything that's not obvious about who that might be, if you could provide information, just so there's no sort of unintended consequence or unknown, that would be great. Thank you.
Great. And there were two different kind of scenarios looking at administering and just where it was dispensing, prescribing, or administering a medication, and taking out the word administering is one way to get to the emergency room, basically, where somebody's administering something, and then there is another way in which, you know, using a phrase that says nothing and this prevents emergency care. Mm-hmm. So two different ways of looking at it. We can discuss those later, but just to flag that for folks.
Thank you.
Is there anything else that that you think we should be aware of before we go to public testimony? Anything we've missed in our discussions here? Okay, well, thank you very much. And let's go to Dr. Butler, because I know he needs to go to another meeting before too long. We also have Dr. Aaron Neris, the state Medicaid pharmacist by phone. And we have Jenny Harden or something like that in the room, I believe. So, or that's from the Department of Commerce. Sorry. So, Dr. Butler, would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and would you give us your feelings on this bill and whether we're hitting the mark or where we're missing it?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Social Services. Good afternoon. It's always a pleasure to speak to one of my favorite committees. Earlier, we had an opportunity to talk about the big picture of opioids, and I talked about addressing the issue of opioid overdose and heroin overdose requires prevention, treatment, as well as reversal of overdose. This discussion today gets to that issue of prevention, because it is very clear that people who become dependent on opioid pain relievers are at much higher risk of eventually using heroin and at risk of the conditions associated with that. The bill, HB 344, incorporates many of the recommendations, of basically all of the recommendations of the Controlled Substances Advisory Committee. If you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I can give a brief overview of that group. If
that would be good.
Be helpful. Controlled Substances Advisory Committee was established in statute in 1982 with the goals of advising the governor about adding, deleting, and rescheduling controlled substances, recommending regulations to the Board of Pharmacy relating to controlled substances, evaluating the effectiveness of treatment programs for persons with controlled substance use disorders, evaluating enforcement policies related to controlled substances, and reviewing budget requests and recommending appropriations related to interventions related to controlled substances. The group, as far as I know, may never have met until this past year. I believe it was the Justice Commission that recognized that we had major issues in the criminal justice system related to controlled substance use, and at least observed that this group did not currently meet, and made the request that the group would come back together, and in May it began to meet again this year. As specified in statute, the committee is chaired by the Attorney General or his or her designee. Also includes the Commissioner of Health and Social Services or designee, the Commissioner of Public Safety or designee, a member of the Pharmacy Board, a peace officer appointed by the governor in consultation with the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, two physicians appointed by the governor, one of whom must be a psychiatrist, and two members of the public. Since the committee began meeting in May, there's been a number of topics that have been discussed, including various models for state regulation of controlled substances, prescription opioid pain reliever and heroin abuse, use of synthetic cannabinoids, and discussion with the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission on opportunities for increasing access to addiction treatment services and reduced rates of prison recidivism. One of the products of the Controlled Substances Advisory Committee was a white paper addressing the Alaska Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. As mentioned, this is part of how we address the opioid issue. The committee had nine specific recommendations, and if your permission, I'll walk through them. It includes requiring prescribers and all pharmacists to register with the Alaska PDMP. The requirement to register is currently in place in at least 20 other states, and the evidence is that requiring registration increases utilization and appears to also be associated then with declining rates of prescription opioid prescribing as well as use. Second, requiring prescribers and pharmacies to review the database when prescribing or dispensing a controlled substance to a patient. Now, this is a very broad recommendation. My understanding is there's at least 22 states that have some sort of requirement like this. This is very broad, though, as stated in the white paper. So I think Ms. Hansen has already discussed some of the exemptions that would probably be desirable, such as an exemption for emergency situations, whether that's at the scene, in an ambulance, or in an emergency department, use that's within a hospital, an inpatient, use in an outpatient surgical center, whether that's part of induction of anesthesia, perioperative or immediate postoperative pain relief, or in hospice settings. The goal here is really to strike the balance between maintaining access to medication and access to care and autonomy of the provider with opportunities to prevent abuse and also to avoid fraud or drug diversion as well. The third recommendation was to authorize prescribers and pharmacists to delegate database access to supervised employees or clinical staff. I think this is a great example of making a system that is more workable and removing barriers to utilization of the PDMP. And I'm yet to talk to a provider who had any reservations about this, that this is a challenge, and being able to have a designated person in the clinic who, for instance, I just use this as an example, can run the appointment list for the day, query the PDMP so that those reports are already generated before the provider sees the patient, will really be very helpful. Fourthly, authorize the Board of Pharmacy to forward unsolicited notifications to prescribers and dispensers about patients who may be obtaining controlled substances inconsistent with generally recognized standards of care. And this would be the push notifications that you mentioned earlier, Mr. Chairman. This is also a very powerful tool, I think something that many of the providers I've spoken with support. I'll just share an example that was brought to me by a provider who utilized the PDMP, saw a new patient who had received prescriptions for about 1,000 opioids tablets over the past year, about 1,200 benzodiazepines, and about half of them were actually from one provider, but they were also going to many other providers as well. Provider A, I'll be a good epidemiologist and keep this anonymous, Provider A contacted Provider B, who had prescribed many of those medications, and Provider B had not been using the PDMP and actually commented, I had no idea that I had prescribed that much. So even within a practice, the PDMP can be useful. But most importantly, it's a communication tool between providers so that a complete recent medical history is available. Five includes collecting the dispensing data and updating the PDMP database weekly. Weekly, you know, there's no magic to it. They're sort of balancing what's the least burden and least cost. Currently, it's monthly. Of the 49 states with PDMPs, we are the only state that requires only monthly reporting. My understanding is Oklahoma is the only state that has a real-time reporting system, but many have reportings that are either weekly or even less than weekly. About a year ago, the PDMP was on the agenda of the Healthcare Commission, actually the last Healthcare Commission meeting, and in discussing with both pharmacists and prescribers opportunity to improve the PDMP, this was one of the items that was highlighted. As I think has already been discussed and mentioned by Ms. Hansen, extreme frequency is a challenge for smaller pharmacies in more remote areas, particularly if there's any challenges with internet access. On the other hand, at least one of the large chains said, we pretty much already download the data daily. So that will be a huge advantage over monthly. So one consideration would be to define it as at least weekly, so that is the minimum, but if a dispenser wants to update it more frequently, that would certainly be encouraged. Six, I think the rest of them address the issue of database access, including the Medicaid pharmacy program and the Medicaid Drug Utilization Review Committee. Currently, the only visibility that the Medicaid pharmacist or the Drug Utilization Review Committee have is on opioids for which there is a Medicaid claim. And I don't know
how much fraud there might be in Alaska, but what we've heard from other states when they began to investigate is that that did occur, that a patient could get the opioids legally and apparently appropriately under the Medicaid program, but then take them on the street, generate enough cash to be able to go to some type of provider, pay cash at the pharmacy, and basically have a great way to be able to be generating a increasing supply of pills that would then be available for diversion. It also includes the state medical examiner. Currently, our state medical examiner is one of the important sources of information regarding the frequency of overdose deaths. Also then de-identified data for the Department of Health and Social Services to be able to look at whether or not what we're doing is making a difference. I think of one of my colleagues in Tennessee who, off the top of his head, is able to tell me how many morphine milligram equivalents were prescribed in his state the past month, how that compares to a year ago, and you know, uses that to assess the success that they've had in addressing this problem, which is a problem in all 50 states as well as territories. So we are in no way alone in this. The expanded authority, I think, is appropriate balance between guaranteeing patient privacy and sort of the need to know, if you will, in terms of people who are responsible for programs or for public health to be able to address this current challenge. So maybe at this point, I'd be happy to pause for questions and I look forward to continuing to discuss this bill.
Good. One of the things that we've been talking about was licensed or registered instead of just anybody in the office. There was a expression of concern about people that didn't have background check, weren't licensed, that would get access to, Mary at such and such an address just got a 30-day prescription of this, and if that information was relayed to somebody else and you get a home invasion or something like that. Does the licensing or is that anything that's problematic, or is that something that you think that would be supported in the medical community as to restricting that delegation to at least somebody that has a license and, you know, whether it's background check or whatever generated that license to avoid that potential problem somewhat?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good point because it raises important questions of making sure we have appropriate safeguards for patient privacy. Certainly someone who is licensed would be under the authority of the boards. What I'm unsure about, and I'd be happy to defer to colleagues from Commerce or to get back with you on this, is how certification may fit into that. The advantage of having that requirement is then you have a built-in method for disciplinary actions if there's any breaches of confidentiality, in addition to those that are basically already in place under the federal HIPAA requirements as well. I think certainly we wouldn't want this to be delegated to a high school volunteer or whatever. It should be someone who actually understands the information that is being downloaded.
Thanks on that. And maybe as we go forward, you know, I think the terms are licensed or registered. I'm not sure what those mean or whether those are terms of art or what. So if people, as they're testifying us, they can give us that information, that would be helpful. One other thing was Maine, I think it was. I saw an article that the governor and the legislature were having a debate whether they were going to put in a provision that the first prescription could only be over 3 days, and one was 3 days and one was 7 days, and they were trying to figure out, but they were limiting the prescription for a limited number of days on at first issuance. So if somebody you know, had a broken finger and they got 3 days worth of painkillers. They weren't getting 30 days of painkiller and thinking, oh, I'm supposed to take these for 30 days if they didn't need them. Have you had any discussions of that topic that at all?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, so what we're now talking about are clinical guidelines and specific issues related to maximum doses. Washington State, I believe, has some legislation related to a certain threshold beyond which a referral to a pain specialist is required. A related issue, but not directly linked to the PDMP. The PDMP is not intended to dictate practice or to, if you will, tell doctors what to do. It's intended to be a communication tool to be able to provide visibility of what has been prescribed for a given patient or by a given provider. I do know nationally there are some draft guidelines specifically focusing on chronic pain management, which defines a threshold of 100 milligram equivalents of morphine. And, you know, there's actually apps for converting the different drugs to that morphine equivalent, beyond which there should be a level of concern. Two of the biggest risk factors for opioid overdose are escalating dose and co-administration of benzodiazepines. So that's where the PDMP can be valuable to clinically to identify people who may be exceeding those thresholds or receiving combinations of drugs that put them at higher risk. And again, I would stress that a single provider may not realize that when they've prescribed an opioid that another provider has prescribed a benzodiazepine, and there's no ill intent here. Each provider is doing what they think is the right thing. The patient may think they're doing the right thing because they're taking all the medicine their providers told them to take, not realizing that they could be putting themselves at risk.
Well, as we go forward, we're looking at curing the problem, not just addressing the database. So, you know, there's a vehicle here. If we need to put something in statute, it's a pretty blunt instrument, but we don't know how effective the guidelines are or how active the medical community is. We're alarmed. So, anyway, we want to... we look forward to your suggestions on that as well. Other questions for Dr. Butler? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just that question I came up with, previously asked about the definition of the practitioner, does that leave any gray areas, or pretty well defined?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I feel like I ought to defer to Vice Chair Vasquez as she pulls Alaska statute off the shelf there. There may very well be a legal definition that I don't want to get crosswise with, but in general the intent is going to be persons who are authorized to be able to prescribe, and in this case specifically controlled substances. So that would include physicians, dentists, advanced practice registered nurses, the physician's assistants, and there may be others as well, but that captures the majority.
Reverend Vasquez.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Dr. Butler. I'm looking up the statute, and I'm looking at Title 08.80.480, which is definitions. And I'm looking at 28. Practitioner means, subsection 28 on page 522, means an individual currently licensed, registered, or otherwise authorized by the jurisdiction in which the individual practices to prescribe and administer drugs in the course of professional practice. And there's also a definition in subsection 26. Pharmacy technician means a supportive staff member who works under the immediate supervision of a pharmacist. And then there is a definition, subsection 23, of pharmacist in charge means a pharmacist who accepts responsibility for operation for pharmacy in a manner that complies with laws and regulations applicable to the practice of pharmacy and the distribution of drugs, and who is personally in charge of the pharmacy and the pharmacy's personnel. And, Mr. Chairman, the last definition is pharmacist. Subsection 22 means the individual currently licensed by the state to engage in the practice of pharmacy. So that's the definition.
Yeah, thank you. And on page 1 of the bill, you'll notice on line 10 there, in each practitioner who directly dispenses the scheduled controlled substances. So at least it's defined there. I guess we can look and see about if we extend that to prescribers as well as the pharmacists, then we'll make sure that it has that as well, because that's all we're talking about here, I think. So, good. There was one other thing that we heard was that very few providers, practitioners were signing up for the data or registering because there were like 7 pages of type 2 font or something that you had to read through and certify that you'd read all that before you could register. Is that the case? And is there something that we need to do to, I mean, it sounded like an agreement to use an iPhone or something. It was, and what I heard was there were a number of people who were reluctant to sit down and read 7 pages of stuff. Is that the case, and do we need to revise that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question, because I am all for removing any kind of obstacles and making this as easy as possible. If I may, I'll just share my own experience. When I registered for the PDMP, it took me 7 minutes to actually complete the online form. I didn't count the number of pages, and I think the only reason it took me 7 minutes is it took me a few minutes to dig out my national provider number, because I didn't need that working in the tribal system, where I didn't use that very often. I knew to have my DEA number, my licensure number. I think the bigger barrier is once the form is completed, it has to be printed, notarized, and mailed in. Now, that took me only 9 minutes because I knew, I mean, we've got Merrill Lynch in our building. I was able to find a notary. That could be certainly a bigger challenge for providers in our more rural areas. And I won't try to speak for the Department of Commerce, but certainly an option, as I understand we're moving towards online license renewal, would be to link the PDMP registration with license renewal. And perhaps that could then just be done online. And what I would hope is it might create the opportunity to no longer need notarization. But again, I'm just offering that as an idea here on the public record, and I'm not with the department that runs that program.
Sure. Okay, are there further questions for Dr. Butler? Thank you.
Thank you.
And let's see. Let's go to Dr. Aaron Norris. Are you online? Medicaid pharmacist?
Hello, yes, thank you, Chairman Seaton.
Yes, I forgot I have this little tool here that we were just talking about. I haven't read the 7 pages on yet that says, were you going to testify, or do you have anything to testify to us, or are you here just for questions?
I don't have anything specifically prepared for today as far as preemptive comments, but I'm available for any questions that the committee may have.
Okay, that'd be fine. And if there are any comments that you have that, you know, not prepared statements, but any comments on the subject that we have, you can go ahead and say go ahead with those, or we'll come back to you if we have questions.
Thank you, Chairman Seaton. At this time, I'll just make sure that I'm available for questions for you and the committee, and Certainly, Dr. Rutler has provided a great wealth of information with his presentation, and we thank you for the opportunity to be available.
Sure, thank you very much, and if you think of any other things, would you, you know, along this line as we prepare this and amendments, it would be good to have those so you can send them to my office. Let's see, we have Jenny Harnden. Is that, sorry, it's not printed, it's written out, and I'm having trouble reading the handwriting.
Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Janie Hevenden. I'm the Division Director for Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And one of the questions just posed was the ability to link to make it faster and easier for registration with the CBPL portal, or our database that we house all the licensing records against the PDMP third-party vendor software program. And the problem is that we haven't really determined whether or not they're going to be able to communicate effectively, and you know, the cost and time associated with being able to do that. That would be something that we would always strive to do and always look for options and opportunities to technologically advance where we can and can afford to.
So at one time we were thinking about the registration being that for the database when people renewed their license. So going forward, is that something that can be put in with license renewal? I mean, we wouldn't be actually having to link the database, mm-hmm. but doing just the registration that, okay, you are now permitted, you know, you're registered with the database with license renewal. Could that be something that could be fairly easily combined?
Thank you.
And yes. If you don't have an answer.
No, we do.
Okay.
absolutely. That is something that we could easily slip in with any of the documentation that we send at renewal time. Could either have the form included or a reminder or a link to the website.
And the renewals are the license renewal, does that have to be notarized, or is that done online and people have their license number and everything, and is that sufficient, or a My Alaska account or whatever? I mean, I know we're all signing stuff now with My Alaska account that is the same thing basically as being notarized, so I'm trying to figure out, have we thought about that way of doing something?
We haven't gotten quite that far into exploring My Alaska as a signing option, but it's definitely something that we can look into and
great.
To make sure that we're always trying to streamline and make it easier for the applicants and definitely the registrants for the PDMP program.
Sure. That's great. If you could look at that and then just get back to us and let us know so that we make sure we're not including something we're not going to do. Did you have some comments you wanted to give us on the program or how it's done or how the registration works or anything else?
Not that Dr. Butler did a great job explaining.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that you knew that if there's anything to add to us.
Clarify.
Representative Vasquez.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How would this bill apply to pharmacies that are registered with the board but located outside of the state?
Through the chair, can you repeat that question?
Okay. How would this bill affect pharmacies that are registered with the board pursuant to 08.80.158 but located outside of the state?
Through the chair, that they would be treated exactly the same way. They would be required to register as long as they're can dispense in the state of Alaska and have a pharmacy license.
And Reverend Vasquez, is that also, I mean, we're getting in telemedicine and those kind of things. If I'm, maybe this is more for, I think Dr. Butler had to leave, but maybe the pharmacy board as well, but medical providers, when we're talking about telemedicine, how does this all fit into that system?
We do.
Go ahead.
We do have the chair of the pharmacy board here and ready to speak, and he could probably be able to answer those questions.
Okay, and we'll bring him up for that. Are there any other questions about the details of licensing or anything?
Only question.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We noticed that the fiscal note has a sort of a program manager position, but you talked about a potential problem with the database talking to each other. And any idea, if that required sort of a technical fix, what that might cost? Any idea at all? And if not, that's totally fine too. But just I know when we talked about it before, I guess that was my first year on the HES committee when we still had the federal grant. I think it was more in the $300,000 range cost. So this is stepped down. And I just can't remember from those details like where those extra costs were and if maybe some of that was, you know, tech support or because it got more costly when we did more frequent, required more frequent updates to it, to the database.
Thank you, through the chair. The vendor that we use, the PDMP vendor, is Apris, and there is a cost associated, and every time you do want to do something with their, this is a third-party software program that we contract with. We have a five-year contract right now, and probably the early estimates, we didn't probably have an idea of what that would cost. This additional expense would be trying to modify our existing database to be able to communicate to make it easier for registrants, which is would be separate than what they probably anticipated back then.
Okay. Thank you.
One thing I think that we were talking about was the weekly, there was an estimate of $5,000 or something like that for the, can you fill us in on that?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, it is, it has, the vendor Apris has given us a cost estimate of $2,100 a month. It'd be approximately about $26,000 a year to go either on a weekly or a daily update.
Oh, either one. Oh, mm-hmm. Great. And do we have that in the fiscal note? Or
yes.
Or if not, you can just.
Is it the services line?
We probably, do we have a note on that?
We do.
I don't think it.
I would need to clarify that.
Sure. Good.
Because I need to follow up on that.
Sure, that'd be fine.
Okay.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know in the past that there's been some difficulties with the Department of Licensing and the time frames involved. Do you anticipate that you'd be able to facilitate this if this goes through in a timely fashion and on the effective date of what this might be?
Thank you, through the chair. Yes, with the program coordinator coordinating it, on behalf of the Board of Pharmacy, I think that they can manage it well. I do believe that there is a little bit of concern about the timing as far as being able to put into regulation before registrants are required to be able to be registered. You can't have an effective and have them be registered all on the same day. So there, I would like to follow up a little bit more articulately what our concern is there. But thank you for that question.
Sure. And you're talking about a delayed effective date of the requirement to be registered until after. I was a little confused.
Be able to put into regulation, to be able to regulate to before the effective date, so that it doesn't happen. Like, we can't start the regulations project, and yet they still have to be registered on that same date. So we could, if I can follow up a little bit with the timing.
That would be great.
Okay.
That would be great. Seeing no further questions, thanks. And can we have Bill Altman, the Board of Pharmacy, and we also have Scott Watts. Was he to come up with you, or are you testifying separately?
Well, he's got different things to ask.
Okay, well, why don't we just take you first then?
Okay.
Great. Thanks for you. Introduce yourself to the record and go ahead and.
Well, my name is Bill Altland, and I'm here mainly as a pharmacist practitioner from a rural remote area. I'm also on the Board of Pharmacy. This is my second term that's been split up. But I'm not really here as a representing the Board of Pharmacy, although I sort of am as well. But mainly, I just wanted to, I was on the work group that studied the idea of the prescription drug monitoring program while on the Board of Pharmacy 8 to 10 years ago. So when this first started, the board chair and myself were the workforce to get this program going. This is a big program. I mean, this is a big problem in the state. It's affected our own family. So I really appreciate the time that you guys are doing looking at this. I wanted to give an example. As a pharmacy provider, I've mainly worked in rural remote areas. I've worked from Barrow to Metlakatla to Dillingham as a locums, and mainly worked in rural remote areas. So I just wanted to bring out mainly concern of mine. Somebody asked about out-of-state licensed farm. The response was licensed pharmacists. I want to give an example of a challenge that happened to me with controlled drugs on Kodiak Island. I was working at a pharmacy, a community retail pharmacy, and a patient came in with prescription controlled drugs. I suspected a problem. I called Walmart, which had just opened, and also the pharmacist at Cana, which is the native health pharmacy. This patient was on record with current controlled drug prescriptions at all three of these pharmacies. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to say that because, and this was years ago, but I wanted to say that because of my question or concern with the definition of a licensed pharmacy, licensed practitioners, and because of a recent opinion of the Attorney General of what that is in our state, particularly in the context of tribal pharmacies, tribal providers, because I've worked at several tribal or native health consortium, native health corporations as a pharmacist. And because of this Attorney General opinion, it makes me wonder who will have to sign up for the PDMP because of the Attorney General's opinion, entities, providers do not have to be licensed in this state. So you're talking about a state law that goes, and I gave the example of Canna and Kodiak with a community pharmacy and chain pharmacy, but I'm worried as a community member, but also as a parent and as a practitioner, how is that going to work? You know, what is the leverage? Because as a Board of Pharmacy member, I think it's important for practitioners to be licensed, and I also happen to agree with pharmacy in particular that there needs to be a licensed, if it's delegated to a licensed technician. So I mean, that's just my opinion, not the board's. Well, I think it may be the board's as well. So if on our island, again, a specific example, rural remote, I live on Prince of Wales Island. My wife and I started the first community pharmacy at Craig, Alaska, and there's a native health consortium community health center right is 7 miles down the road at Kowak. In 3 weeks, they will be getting their new pharmacist at the tribal entity. And I want to say that we sold this pharmacy 8 months ago, so I don't really anymore have any economic interest in this, although that's something that I would have had in the past. But this, as I understand the Attorney General's opinion and how the medical board has written a reg to try to keep a handle on tribal providers, they can't license them according to the Attorney General's opinion. So when you're talking about a state law for state licensed practitioners to include pharmacy and pharmacy tech, with our example and Kodiak's example, well, Sitka, Juneau, Ketchikan, where there's tribal, and these are more urban areas, how are you going to know, or how is a prescriber going to know, or what's the leverage to get the licensees, the providers that are not licensees, into the system? Because on Prince of Wales Island, in 3 weeks, there'll be a new pharmacist go to the search clinic at Kowak, and will not have to get a license, you know. And the pharmacy in the community health center at Kowak, because of that opinion, the way I understand it, will not have to get a license. So what is the power of, and won't have to, you know, have to have a license somewhere. But to me, the license part is important, and to me, I don't understand how it is important to get all the data from everywhere, including for our pharmacy. It would have been for Seattle Interstate, because there's a lot of, and there are some states that are doing that, but Seattle is a major health provider hub for southern southeast Alaska. So so anyway, I just wanted to pose that to you guys. Again, in that same context, as a citizen and a pharmacy provider in Alaska, you know, that same challenge is, I've worked in Barrow, where a lot of the patients were, maybe most of the patients were not at the tribal clinic in the pharmacy, were not tribal members. So I just personally have an opinion with, I have an issue with the opinion of the Attorney General's. I understand why they made that opinion. It took them 10 years to render that opinion, because I was on the board when we asked for the opinion 10 years ago, and until the Affordable Care Act came out, there was no opinion, and that was written into the Affordable Care Act about tribals, entities or corporations are exempt from licensure in a state. So, in the context of a prescription drug monitoring program, I know that we have our own system on Prince of Wales Island, and that we have a pain management committee of providers from both the Peace Health Clinic in Craig, the Native Clinic in Kowak, and our pharmacy, which is the only pharmacy, to talk about patients who have pain management issues, we think. And I taught the providers at Kowak Tribal Clinic how to use the PDMP. So anyway, that's a concern of mine.
We've sure noted that down, and we'll see if we can figure out where we go on that. So, Representative Vasquez.
I guess we'll have to track down the Attorney General's opinion, but I know looking at the statute 08.80.475, it states, quote, federal facilities not affected. This chapter does not apply to the safe storage, preservation, dispensing, or control of drugs in a federally operated hospital institution. So it depends who's controlling that clinic.
Depending on the definition of
operated.
And you know, the board of
probably also the military.
Well, yeah. Exactly. The military is a closed system. I was a pharmacy tech in the Army, and those are federal beneficiaries, the patients. Okay. I mean, I can make a case for that, but soldiers, dependents are federal beneficiaries. Metlakatla, that's a reservation, all federal beneficiaries if they're. But the difference in Alaska is that many of the rural, remote, and even not even rural, the patients are not native, they're not federal beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. They're just people, and that's the main health provider. Right. And I could see that creeping in, like working at Beryl, there's Alaska Air every day, Dillingham, same thing, come to see specialists in Anchorage. And this is a good program. But I just have a problem seeing how it's going to work with this relatively new decision that, and that AG opinion is on our Board of Pharmacy website. Oh. I wanted to look at
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is just sort of anecdotal from your personal experience as a, you know, person in the profession. And I'm just wondering, you know, there was a theory that doctors were sort of over-prescribing, you know, pain meds, opioids, because, you know, just not aware of sort of the extent of the problem. You know, because you're the one dispensing those prescriptions, are you seeing a scale back? Because I'm just wondering if we have to go, you know, as part of the solution, go do something with the doctors about that as well.
Well, we sold our pharmacy 8 months ago.
Okay.
One of the reasons that my wife's a pharmacist too, and again, we're in a rural area. One of the reasons we got out is because we have four kids we raised on Prince of Wales Island. Is, you know, we're the only pharmacy, you know, like a lot of rural areas. So you either do it or you don't, and then you got to make. I mean, there were difficult decisions, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So I think it's better now. I think this program for monitoring is excellent, and it's needed, and it's, you know, on the board gets the reports for how it's different this year than it was last year, and my colleague will talk about our concerns as pharmacists, but specifically about the bill, but I just wanted to mainly emphasize my concern with how the bill's going to work like it's intended.
Great, thanks for that. So let's get Scott Watts. Are you there?
Thanks.
Welcome. Would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent for the record, and go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. Sure. Yes, my name is Scott Watts. I'm pharmacist and Juneau resident for the last 26 years, and basically here to speak on behalf of your bill with the committee from the pharmacy perspective, as an independent pharmacy or a retail pharmacist. And definitely agree and appreciate what the bill is trying to do and what the committee is working on to decrease the over-prescribing, over-dispensing, overuse of specifically narcotics that, you know, may be used by the wrong people or get out on the street to get the wrong people started on these narcotics. A couple concerns that we have in the retail world, I guess, and many of them have been brought up. The near real time, that was a good clarification. The real time submission would be difficult to do for many pharmacies and increase the cost, whereas nightly or weekly submission, I believe, would do what the bill is intended to do, or the PDMP. One of the big things I see is to check, or the pharmacies are inputting the data. Where it really needs to be checked is when the prescriber is writing the prescription. If we see it's skipping a step if the prescriber doesn't check that, and then we as a pharmacist get to see the prescription, we check it, we're talking phone calls back to the physician, we can't get a hold of them. It turns to be a rigmarole in the pharmacy, pulling our time from people that deserve the care versus people trying to abuse the prescription. So I think it would cut down time for everybody. So if we could look at that would be wonderful. The licensed, registered individuals, I think those people that are licensed, registered, have more stake in the game. They have more to lose if they do something incorrectly, specifically that was mentioned before. So I would like to see that changed also. I guess the amount of prescriptions needs to start at the prescriber, so that was brought up earlier. If they can be looking at the database initially. That's all I've got. There was a little bit mentioned on fees to keep this program going. I think it's a very, we see it in, I don't know the amount of states have this program, a program like this, but it's very important, very worthwhile program. I'd hope the fees don't lay on the pharmacy shoulder entirely. There's a lot of people using this, prescribers, law enforcement, you guys know the people in the department, but hopefully we can all chip in and keep the program going if that's what it takes, if the grants dry up. So that's what I've got, if there's any questions.
Great, thanks. Representative Tara?
Thank you. Just one quick question. If we did want to look at that, I had not thought of law enforcement as being part of that potential puzzle. If you have any kind of the comprehensive view on who all the users are, and we're running out of time here, but I would, if you could email that to me, that'd be very helpful for me to kind of think through, because I just think it's so important that we make
look
make
at all the
work
groups
and make it work, and know it's going to be sustainable so we can figure out the problem.
Okay, through the chair, I can do that.
Great. And we do have two other people online to testify, so thank you, and do feel free to send us any other thoughts that might occur. Thank you again for your testimony. I think it's Matt Keith, Vice President of Pharmacy for Geneva Woods. Are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity to address the committee. I agree with my colleague, Mr. Watts, and Bill Altman. There's a few things, though, specifically I'd like to address as well.
Matt, would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you're representing first for the record?
My name is Matt Keith. I'm Vice President of Pharmacy for Geneva Woods Healthcare, and I'm also a pharmacist. I do drive a desk some, but I am also a practitioner in Alaska for 15 years in a variety of different settings, my infusion, retail, long-term care, and hospital. So I do know frontline pharmacy. I've also spent 15 years doing prison healthcare reform, so I'm very versed and understand the challenges around opiate use and controlled substances. I love the PDM program. I particularly like the new portal that we've got with this new vendor. It's much easier to use. It's quicker to access. There's more flexibility in how you look at the data. So my hat's off to everyone for that change. And I support the concept of the bill in an effort to reduce abuse and misuse and improve patient safety and increase the number of people who have access to look at the data. There is a little bit of a disconnect for me around how that will get done. I mean, I'm sure the committee has realized that requiring a mandatory review by doctors and pharmacists every single prescription for all controlled substances will be logistically burdensome and will add cost. I mean, there's no way that could be avoided. Allowing agents to be designated to do that, in our case, it would be, I agree with the licensure concept of a pharmacy technician, makes sense. But just the same, most of us, and I would assume in the physician's office as well, don't have people who have lots of capacity in their day to do these extra chores. You may know that there are a number of programs now related to prescription drugs that require pharmacists to go out to websites and register patients and put additional information, perhaps labs and others, before we can dispense. So this is a growing area of demand on pharmacies' times to proactively review the PDMP on every single controlled substance prescription before it's dispensed is likely to have some impact on the service level and responsiveness for the patients in lobbies, particularly in a retail environment, perhaps less so in a med center long-term care environment like our programs because of the way that they operate, but it's still going to have an impact. And so I kind of also mirror Mr. Watt's comments around, you know, drug abuse and overdose don't happen if the prescription doesn't get written in the first place. And if doctors aren't looking at this type of information before they prescribe, then they've already let the horse out of the barn. And so now, on the pharmacy end, we're reactively trying to catch this stuff and notify people if they're not required to engage in this as well. And I heard the reading out of 74 versus 344, so I see that there's some disconnects between those things that probably need to be ascertained. Dr. Butler very appropriately pointed out some exemptions that have to be included. The word administer is something that a pharmacist doesn't do. That would include nurses, and we certainly wouldn't want nurses in hospitals to have to go to PDMT before they gave doses of meds, or in ambulatory surgical centers and whatnot. One of the other things that I think has been missed a little bit is the holistic oversight of these patients. And for example, in our programs, both in retail but also in the MedSet program, we enroll our patients in service. So anybody on a chronic pain program is enrolled and is expected to follow certain expectations around how they get their meds filled. And they sign voluntary agreements that outline those things, much like you would see in a chronic pain center. We meet with the chronic pain clinics and doctors, and we look at their agreements, and they see our agreements, and we share that information so that we know each other, and together we know our patients. And to me, that's the kind of clinical care practitioner approach that has to be part of any good program. So kind of my last comment would be to really reassess whether we're trying to address chronic opiate use, or if this really needs to be all forms of all controlled substances, everyone, you know, anxiolytics, antipsychotics, medications used for seizure disorders, because the way the bill is written is every single controlled substance and proactive. So those are fairly onerous things to do. Totally support the concept. The logistics are going to be problematic.
And thanks, Matt. And one of the questions that we have, of course, we're not pharmacists or providers either. So would you, what schedules of controlled substances would you think should be included in this?
Well, if it's going to be done in a proactive way like this, and the biggest concern is opiate overdose, which is, you know, rife in the media, and it would be C2s or Schedule 2. Now, Dr. Butler pointed out that one of the big risk factors for overdose is concomitant benzodiazepines. Well, they're not Schedule 2, they're Schedule 3, but now you've opened the barn door further. However, if you're checking patients on a Schedule 2 med and we're reporting but not required a mandatory review in advance of dispensing the benzodiazepines, you're going to see that. In other words, the focus should be on the patient, not just one drug. Does that make sense, Mr. Chairman?
It sure does. Like I say, we're just not, you know, this has got 1A through 5 or right. Something, and I have no idea what any of those things are. So if the pharmacists in the group can send a, we're running kind of out of time, but if the pharmacists in the group wouldn't mind emailing me their recommendations of what it would be that should be included in reporting and what it should be in before is being dispensed or prescribed, you check on that, would be very helpful to the committee. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and because you're very experienced here, I'm just wondering, like you mentioned the class 3 Schedule 3 benzodiazepines, and for example, one of the side effects of those, you know, could be, you know, the sort of suicidal tendencies and sort of the, you know, side effects associated with that, that I think if you were looking at it, you know, you're suggesting looking at it holistically, like with the overall patient. I mean, is that the kind of stuff that you're kind of getting at in terms of, you know, how some of these are, the usage may be, you know, there'd be overlapping problems with the different drugs that are being used? And do you know if, outside of the opioid problem, if this type of information is being used for anything like that, you know, elsewhere, like tracking with suicide or something?
Well, I'm not sure about suicide. if you report off schedules, but then you only mandatorily review the C2s or opiates, and if the primary concern is to reduce opiate abuse, then you're going to see those, but you're not going to have to necessarily mandatorily review each and every other kind of class of drug before it's dispensed, so that you see your greatest risk patient population, which I think this bill is targeting, which is opiate abuse and overdose. Now, you know, the benzos are interesting because they increase the risk for overdose and negative outcome, but you mentioned suicidal ideation. Well, every antidepressant on the market mm-hmm. has been associated with that, so mm-hmm. and they're not controlled substances. So mm-hmm. I mean, it kind of depends on what you're really targeting in terms of improved outcomes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. So thank you very much, and Representative Wu has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, I guess more of a comment or a question, but if the prescribers also went onto the database to check before they wrote a prescription, they could also see what other prescriptions. Would the benzodiazepines also show up on this on the database, or is this just the different controlled substances? And also, if the prescribers were looking at it, as we said, we'd be going further upstream to prevent or reduce the amount of delays, I guess, at the pharmacy, because if the person never got the prescription, then they would never be waiting.
Well, absolutely. And remember that if we report all controlled substances, then yes, the doctor would be able to see every form of controlled substances, including the ones that can have additive negative outcome risk. And you're right. If the doctor doesn't write the prescription in the first place, that patient can't go take it and have bad things happen, or get a cash bill and sell it. So, it's a much more proactive thing than trying to catch it on the back end when it's dispensed.
Thank you, and I think that's the committee's intention here. So, thank you very much, Matt. And if you get a chance to line those things out and send them to my office, that would be great by email.
I'd be more than happy to do that, and I'm available to you if you have any further questions at any point.
Great, thank you. And we have Dan Nelson online from Fairbanks.
Yes, this is Dan Nelson. Can you hear me okay?
We sure can. Sorry we're running so short in time. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and who you represent, and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Dan Nelson. I live in Fairbanks, and representing myself, I'm a practicing pharmacist and director of pharmacy at Chief Andrews Health Center, the Native Clinic here in Fairbanks, the pharmacy. I'd just like to echo what has already been said by other pharmacy representatives that have already spoken this afternoon to a large degree, and just add a few small points very quickly. One is that the time requirement, even if this is a delegated task to check every single controlled substance prescription, would be onerous on the part of pharmacies. Many of the high volume, busy retail pharmacies in Alaska are doing upwards of 1,000 prescriptions of a day, with a fairly good percentage of those being controlled substances, upwards of 10% being controlled substances. So I've timed doing the queries, and just to actually get the report to be generated through the computer once you're logged in. Typically, putting in all the information takes about 2 minutes, which is a relatively quick process. But then there is part of that that would have to be the interpretation of that information that should not be a task that's delegated. That should be something that's done by either a practitioner or a pharmacist. So again, I would echo what has been said by others that this really should not be a thing that's delegated or relegated to pharmacy. That should be done upstream by the prescribers not done after the prescription is written. I think that the fact that the number of people who have already registered with the prescription drug monitoring program vastly outweighed by dispensers over prescribers shows that pharmacists are very interested in stemming the prescription drug abuse epidemic, and we really want to play an active role in that, but it's very frustrating when we continue to get problematic prescriptions, what we see as problematic prescriptions on a recurring basis. And I know that this committee has taken this issue very seriously, and I would like to applaud you for that. One suggestion I have that may, I think, really help out in this regard would be to consider a lot of states have gone to mandatory continuing education in certain disease states, and those would be things like HIV, pain management is another one, and I think that would be something that could be a regulatory change that would really improve some of the health outcomes, and that's what we're really looking at, is preventing these overdose situations and the prescription drug use problem that we're dealing with. So considering looking at some sort of mandatory regulation for opioid abuse or pain management, prescribing for both prescribers and pharmacists would be potentially very helpful. And that's basically it. I think the main thing, though, is the time requirement for pharmacies to do this would be extremely onerous. For my pharmacy, I calculated anywhere from 2 to 3 hours of additional work a day. So I think that would be a big deal for us to tackle.
So, Dan, would you agree then with the idea of looking at Schedule 2, even if the others were entered, but for having to check? I guess that would be for providers anyway, not for pharmacists. But, of course, the data has to be in there.
I think that would be definitely a good starting point. It's a little bit confusing for people that aren't in the pharmacy or health, professions that deal with this on a regular basis. But the way that medications are broke down by the FDA and the DEA, as far as what schedule, whether it be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6, really has less to do whether it's an opioid or a benzodiazepine or a stimulant like Adderall or Concerta. So just because something is a Schedule 2 does not necessarily mean it's an opiate. I think that's what this bill is rightfully targeted at, is opioids. So opioids actually run the gamut from anywhere from Class 2 to 3, 4, and 5. So it's, I don't know if just looking at Class 2 controlled substances bill would really effectively capture what you guys are trying to accomplish, but I think that's something that maybe for offline discussion would be appropriate, definitely.
Sure. Well, that would be great, and if you have any ideas for a way to write that for capturing what we're trying to get is at the opioids or whatever is the addictive stuff.
Yeah, and that would hopefully make you think. Like I said, it's something that it gets pretty far into the weeds and can be confusing. So I'd like to make this as succinct as possible, and I'd be happy to do that. I'll do that.
Great, thank you very much. Sure, appreciate it. Representative Tarr has a question.
Thank you, and I guess just a request. If you're going to send that information, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would be interesting. What I would love to do is sort of, I see we have sort of a crisis situation now with the opioid problem, get ahead of that and then think about how we use this in a more holistic and comprehensive way. If you had any thoughts of sort of an evolution in looking at, different substances that we should be concerned about but are not, don't have the same immediate need for attention, I think that would be instructive.
Yeah, I think there's some really interesting stuff that the CDC has just come out with some draft guidelines that address exactly what you're talking about, and I think it's been already once at this administering in and of itself, but it has to do with benzodiazepine abuse issues that are coming up and the co-occurring benzodiazepine opioid abuse that is really becoming somewhat problematic, and I'll definitely address that as well.
Thank you.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Dan. Appreciate that. And we are running late, but is there anyone else in the audience that wanted to testify that we didn't get to? Okay, great. Seeing none, I appreciate everybody's help with this bill as we go forward, and like I say, make sure that you send anything in by email. We'll get it to all committee members, and with that, we'll be adjourned at 5:15.